With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minutes, I'm Trick.
Time for the Carol Cox Show right here at K108. If you have questions or comments for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080. And now here's Carol.
Hey, good morning. Welcome to the Carol Cox Show. A little bit of Donald Byrd, flight line. Anyway, I think what we'll have is a very informative conversation this morning. I have four people, or five actually, in the studio. One is the administrator, Mr. Kurt Cottrell, the administrator for the state parks, and Jonathan and Micah Dawn, and John Ave. Awai. And he's the guy that was going to come in before, and he missed his bus or something. But we're really going to be talking about, and you can join us later on at 808-888-5204, some serious issues about safety. And did you know that social media actually plays a role in many of these incidents of injury, fallen hikers, lost hikers, the whole gambit, social media. And I've got to add one little thing. Just on Thursday, I went out to photograph birds along the coast there, the tropic birds at the Lanai Lookout. And as I'm sitting there up on the cliffs, and I see this young lady walking alone on the Kalani Anaoli, with all the mountainous turns and curves, and she's on the right side with traffic coming to her back. And I waved to her and said, "Look, that's not safe. Come across." So I was leaving anyway. I started a conversation with her. She showed me she was trying to find she was from Japan, spoke broken English. She showed me, she asked me, "Do I know where this site is?" It was a social media site that was guiding her to Cocoa Head Trail, but behind the backside of Cocoa Head Trail, going up the backside, and there was some lady perched on some ledge in the picture.
They're going up to the arch.
The arch.
That's where she was going.
And she had on flat gym shoes. I mean, not ready, and it was late afternoon, so she was looking to go. So she caught a bus from Waikiki all the way to Sandy Beach, got off, and then she got off the bus, and there she began to try to figure out where.
Yeah.
So I conversed with her a bit and then encouraged her to, it was too late, you're alone, you don't have the adequate attire to where I wouldn't encourage you. So if I was you, I would go up Cocoa Head Crater where you see the other 50, 60 people.
Hundreds.
Yeah. So that's social media, and I can tell you she could be a candidate if she had left at the time she left. I have no doubt that there would have been a helicopter rescue for her, or a lost hiker or something. Yeah. And then just as we were talking, there was one helicopter that responded to something.
No, Carol, that is exactly the example. You nailed it, because here's an out-of-country visitor going to a feature that years ago only locals knew about it, or like the Hawaii Trail and Mountain Club. And because of social media, people are going to places like the Arch, which has there's no marker along the road. It's right across from a parking lot for another water feature. I'm not even going to say where it is,
yeah.
Right? I'm going to be very vague about that. But I've been up there. You know, it's not illegal, but it does require a certain skill set. It's very steep. It's unmarked, and from there you can continue up to the summit of Cocoa Crater.
Mm-hmm.
But it's social media is the irresponsibility or the irresponsibleness of social media directing people to these places so they can get that next really cool photograph, and then they post it, and then someone else sees it, and it just exponentially skyrockets of people going to these places where years ago you never saw anybody at these locations except an occasional local person.
Mm-hmm. Who knew the terrain and know that the either in that area the decaying rocks or the weathered rocks or the breaking of the crust, what is it, the deposits and all, very fragile, brittle.
It's slippery, you know, and it's breaking apart. And you're right, folks that are, you know, born and raised here or been here a long time versus someone who's here for a week, they know in advance what they're in for. They know how to be prepared. Like, you never, ever, in my career at DLNR, which spans maybe 29 years, I'm almost at 30 years, I've never seen anything in the paper on the news of a hunter getting rescued. And hunters go into the most gnarliest, inaccessible locations in search of pigs, but they also have the highest skill set and preparedness. Plus, they're really prideful. If a hunter got hurt, he would probably want to crawl out before getting fire rescue. But nonetheless, that's a real good example versus a visitor with, you know, flat shoes, you know, just wanting to go on this short hike, but having no clue what they're getting into.
And generally, when you're going hiking, you want to know the terrain, you want to know the substrate. What you're in California, you want to know the granite, and you know that granite can be trusted to some degree, but other times, if it's weathered granite, it's and thawed and frozen and expanded, it's quite brittle.
Yeah.
Well, I don't even want to compare the basaltic structure or formations here, or the strata. This basalt here is very tricky. You can reach in what looks like a nice solid boulder, or solid, is it will crumble in your hand, and there you go down the cliff.
No, that's exactly right. It's all heavily weathered, and the tough material, like at Coco, same as at Diamond Head, it is the reason there's an arch there is because the whole underside of it disappeared. It weathered away, leaving just a slightly more solid, you know, surface portion of the old, you know, flows and stuff.
The caldera that built up, and that's what's happening. They're collapsing in most of them, and the gravity taking its effect, weather taking its effect. And I looked at that picture she showed me, and I thought, oh my God, I can't believe this. We're going to be talking about this Sunday. This is the
perfect
is a
example.
But thankfully, she was willing to listen. But at one point there, she was still sold on, I want to get see this girl. I want to get this. I want to be right there.
Right.
You know, well, why don't we just fly and take a picture with the helicopter and Facebook, you know, Photoshop yourself in it or something. But Micah, Jonathan?
Well, that's the part I kind of noticed, I seen is that the challenge to differentiate between reality and social media seems to be kind of one of the challenges. And, you know, you got, like you said, you have the lady just seeing something on the screen and she wants to go up there not even knowing what's going on. And we experience hikers like that as well, going up to these hikes that are illegal. They're dangerous. There's possible, you know, unexploded ordinances or whatever. And their answer is, oh, we found out about it on a social media site and whatnot. And my brothers and John could probably add more to just the places that these people are being led without having any clue to where they're even going before they even get there, you know. And it's a harm to them as well as, you know, the environment too. Just a couple weeks ago, we went up with 808 cleanups up to the Miley Pillbox hike just to clean up a bunch of graffiti. Mm-hmm. You know, so now not only are you getting people hurt, but you have all this desecration and graffiti going up in these high places that are hard to reach. And I'm just like, I'm not a very, you know, experienced hiker myself, but the only time I go hiking is to clean up graffiti. And it's just,
was that the pink one? Is that the pink bunker?
Just like,
I saw that.
It's pretty steep.
Why would someone want to paint a pillbox pink?
Well,
is there some social media thing going on?
People will leave their Instagram account, you know, their tag, their handles or whatever to show that they were there. There were some tags up there that were actually kind of in like a memory of somebody that had passed away. And, you know, it was just kind of, you know, like a memorial. But then I just looked at it in the way of, you know, there's other possible ways that you could memorialize someone without having to be destructive because that, and when you are destructive to the Aina, I mean, the memorial that you gave them is kind of, you know, not as positive.
That's the same issue we had up at Kaivi before we did the capital improvement projects. We had a barricade that had lots of metal, and the people were hanging locks.
Oh, yes.
The locks of love. And it started over in Europe, and there was this bridge over some river. It might have been in France.
Paris, I think.
And it was there were so many locks that it collapsed. It had actually, you know, pulled the weight of the locks, pulled the railing into the river. And so, but what Mike is talking about is true. People, not only do they want to see stuff, but they want to try to leave a mark that they were there. And, you know, again, social media, who would have thought, you know, 10 years ago that there would be this viral kind of thing of hanging locks on metal objects in state parks or along trails. I mean, that the only way these kind of activities spread is now because it's pushed through social media, Before, you go up to, like, Kaivi, if there's a couple locks hanging there, you go, oh, somebody lost their key. And now you realize it's part of a movement. And that's what I see as a manager of our park resources, is that the trends of how people behave now is much different than it was like 20 years ago. And raves and wanting to, go to historic, bunkers up on the west side and leave their marks on these historic features. Even the folks at Hanakapiai piling, making rock piles and whatnot, and then everybody sees it and they all want to replicate it. And hey, folks, we're at 9 million visitors a year now. So it's a perfect storm for the state of record numbers of visitors and the most efficient way ever devised to spread information through social media. And it's really like a perfect storm of impact on both natural and cultural sites.
When we say social media, give us some so parents and everyone out there can be aware of what's going on. When we say social media, what does that really mean? Instagram, Facebook, and what other sources, or how does that go? Is there hiking sites?
Jared, you guys are millennials. You know more than I do.
Well, my daughter knows more about it than I do. But yeah, Instagram, Facebook. But for our visitors, it's, Yelp, Bing.
Oh, good point.
It's just TripAdvisor. And that's what's causing people to find these places, because now you get the coordinates to get there.
That's a really good point.
You can zoom in on a satellite, look for a landmark, and just drive to that landmark and look up, and there's your hike.
I did a few checking here and there, and nothing in those Facebook or Instagram posts say it's illegal, it's private property or government property.
No. Or dangerous.
There was one travel agency that was had on their social media Instagram site about telling the people to go swim with the dolphins out at Makua. And so I contacted them and asked them if they knew anything about the dolphins and the interaction. And they didn't. But they got kind of defensive, I guess, because they didn't. They had a post up that showed somebody swimming with a dolphin. I let them know that it's kind of a controversial post, and what you're doing is promoting, harmful behavior. And for them, what I kind of saw was just say, hey, we just want to get people out there, spread the word, market, tourism of Hawaii and whatnot. But what we've seen in these places that never had 100 visitors in a year, now you get hundreds of visitors in a day.
For this one site and then the one little trail. I definitely want to talk about the historical sites, the historical significant sites, and also... you being government, you operating with the strapped budget anyway. You always,
absolutely.
And so, what does that translate into? A rescue, or having to go back up and clean it up, or what does that translate into dollar wise?
It's we don't do rescue. The county fire guys do the rescue, but I know that their costs are increasing as a result. Like the newspaper headline, last week of how many sites they have to go rescue people at. And I have it right here. And it's real interesting. Like Diamond Head leads the pack in terms of number of rescues in a year at 59. And what's real interesting is Diamond Head is probably one of the safest trails you could hike. It's got rails, it's got steps, it's engineered from World War I time. But we're up to 3,000 people a day at Diamond Head.
Visiting
Diamond Head Crater. And a few years ago we hit 2, and we thought, wow, that's it, we're maxed. We can't absorb any more. And then it went up by another 1,000. And so when you have, and that's, I think, the kind of the trend I want to kind of focus on, and that is because visitation is so high, that we're getting greater numbers of people with two issues. One is they don't have the skill or the fitness or the understanding of what they're getting into. Diamond Head, it's mainly heat stroke or sprained ankles because they're wearing, in some cases, high-heeled shoes because they're, they're just thinking, hey, it's just a short walk up. But then, farther on down the list, it has Pu'umanamana, the Crouching Lion Trail, where we have signs that say, don't go here, enclosed area, dangerous cliffs. And, you know, we've had those signs there for about a year. And last year, unfortunately, a 20-year-old girl fell, you know, hiking there, mm-hmm. and she died. And then fire rescue had to risk themselves to go and extract it. And, you know, I can only think of the grieving family, you know, dealing with the loss. And then just for fun, or just to see, I Googled Pu'umanamana, and there's all these, like, YouTube videos of people with their selfie sticks running with music along this very narrow ridge. And as we talked about, crumbling basalt, you know, unstable. And I think it was Micah said earlier, the reality of the resource versus what social media is presenting, there's this disconnect. It's becoming kind of fantasy until you fall, right? But they, mm-hmm. they're getting that huge, you know, adrenaline rush of the image. And years ago, I was at Diamond Head, and two guys were walking down with a selfie stick, and I actually heard the guy say, it never happens unless you post it. And that, I think, is a really, I think that's kind of the mantra that's going on. It's like, it only counts if I can show it to as many people as possible.
Right.
But in terms of cost, sure, you know, the wear and tear on our facilities, and when you have more visitors, you have more opportunity for car break-ins and theft, because it becomes a market. So we're cleaning up glass from broken, you know, windows and whatnot. And obviously our comfort stations and the rubbish being generated is increasing. The vandalism, that's a little bit more isolated. The other real huge cost is dealing with the homeless situation, which is a sidebar issue. But I would argue that I think we're having more and more homeless because of, you know, the bed and breakfast market, where people used to, like, their Ohana units were for their families, or they'd rent them out to make some extra bucks. And now people are renting out, you know, their Ohana units for tourists. And I think that might be contributing to why we have more and more homeless folks, because those kind of really low-budget rentals are now getting kind of pimped out for the visitor industry. So it's like a spider web of impact because of this huge visitor industry and the ability to market really fast.
And I'm aware that there are a couple B&Bs or bed and breakfasts or whatever that actually had, you go into them or have the occasion of going, they advertise or they have on their walls or in their office sites for the guests to go and visit, and even have maps, and even have state park maps that they've gone and taken from the state park and put them in there, and it looks so official. It's like that trail, I wouldn't find myself on it, you know. I think it starts with the individual. Like I have this one occasion, and I used to backpack a lot, do the Sierras and just wherever, Yosemite, you name it. But I remember this one occasion, we had the craving to sit down and drink some wine over the Grand Canyon and play backgammon.
Sounds really fun.
And you know, sandstone, right?
Sure.
And it can be brittle and can be unpredictable. And I still, to this day, sit back and think about that occasion where we're sitting looking down thousands of feet.
Yeah.
And we're sitting there on a rock ledge.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, having no knowledge if it was completely seated, well, our weight would take it up. But to this day, I think, wow. So I understand the desire to do something adventuresome. And I think each of us have that, but it's managing that.
Correct. And I have a photo of me sitting at the Grand Canyon when I was there visiting my sister with my kids years ago, right on the edge, same thing. And you know, what's interesting, though, is I looked at it very closely, and the Grand Canyon, the National Park Service, is fascinating because they don't have any signs.
Right.
You know, and the federal government versus the state government, their degree of protection. But more importantly, the National Park Service understands, and they have the manpower and regulatory authority to realize that nature is nature,
mm-hmm.
and they're providing these experiences for nature. And I think their position is that the user just has to assume a greater deal of personal responsibility if they make those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And on state government, for some reason, we're more of a target for when people get injured. Then suddenly it starts this perception of the lottery of settlements due to personal injury. But you don't see a lot of lawsuits. I'm sure people fall into the Grand Canyon all the time,
mm-hmm.
you know, because their numbers, you know, are huge for that park. But either people are assuming their own, the families are assuming personal responsibility, or they're so buttressed legally that you can't touch them. But that personal responsibility for your safety, but also the personal responsibility for your impact is I think, what is eroding now, either impact to cultural sites like the cave, where people have no idea of the cultural value, you know, of the cave up above Makua, or in our cases at Pu'umanamana, that little trail now, it looks like a cattle trail, mm-hmm. and it's eroding. And from the sheer mechanics of feet going, you know, you have now sediment coming into the street, and, you know, people are literally chewing up the mountain to get up there. So those are some of the impacts.
You made a lot of good, valid points, but I just wanted to get back to you about the rescues about for emergency response. And, yeah, definitely in certain, you know, like Diamond Head and other, those are the common places where you hear a lot of rescues, but again, there's now all these, there's other, also new places emerging where, yeah. you know, the rescue, fire rescue and the department has to go to these places in really dangerous areas. And what makes it dangerous, the hike can be dangerous, but it's also even more dangerous to actually go and rescue someone in these areas. Mm-hmm. And hopefully yeah. these people, you know, I mean, to come down from a helicopter, you know, in a basket.
Repelling in a basket.
Yeah. In windy conditions where you can be swaying. And, yeah. I mean, that makes it really dangerous for the personnel, the fire department or any emergency response team. So, these people that, you know, hopefully they can just, you know, they have, like, obviously, I mean, they're not regarding their own safety and, you know, they're taking risky behaviors, but hopefully they can keep in mind, okay, if something happens to me, how is it gonna, who's gonna come help me, you know? Also, the cost that it takes, you know, I mean, they're not getting charged for these rescues, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they pay for the yeah. ambulance, but not for the actual department, fire department or rescue team coming to help them. And then also, it's just taking, you know, you can go, I mean, understand, hiking is a very enjoyable activity and everyone should be able to enjoy it. But do it with, you know, safety involved and prevention too, you know. I mean, you can prevent yourself from getting hurt by just staying on the trail.
Or not and, going over somebody's fence at 2 a.m.
Yeah, not going over somebody's fence right. at 2 a.m., you know. And they're just taking people, when if they, you know, get involved with risky behavior or in hiking, then someone has to come rescue them, then they're just taking manpower away, you know.
Yeah.
To me, it's unnecessary manpower away from, you know, from the other people that may really do need some kind of emergency help, where there is yeah. just an accident that was unavoidable, you know, that happened.
And all so. Because you wanted a selfie or you ignored yeah. the sign yeah. that say it started when you left your hotel room going, knowing you're sneaking in because you don't see 1,000 people going there. You see people hurrying to get in and right, in a nefarious
well,
way.
Well, standard hiking behavior doesn't start at 2 in the morning.
John, being that you're a firefighter in the fire department, is there any change in difference of the morale in the fire department regarding these types of issues? Is there been situations where now they're short-staffed because of certain issues? Or is there, from the inside, because a lot of people don't get to hear the inside, is there anything from, you know, being a firefighter that you can share over the years that you've experienced there?
No, I haven't been in that long, so, but it's just, I guess, I guess the firefighter, and just hear the talk, you know, I mean, just firefighters are getting tired, not tired, I mean, we want to help be there for people, but it's just, it's unnecessary, you know, mm-hmm. like, especially when you got to go in at nighttime or something to hike for these people, and,
yeah.
and you know, knowing that, just knowing that there could be a real, or more, someone else in dire need of help. You know,
who's not trespassing.
Each time that helicopter fire up or the phone rings at the 911 that involving a hiker or a person in that recreational behavior activity, you're looking at a helicopter. That's a machine. Now you're putting a man in it or three men in it or two men in to repel, depending on the circumstances. How is it going to come to a point where, and this is what's puzzling, is that I don't hear anybody discussing through the legislative process or the administrative process to say, this is a danger. Is it worth it? But no one is willing to let you fall from a cliff and just lay there and die. Mm-hmm. So you're compelled just right. by the nature of the situation and exposing your workforce, your mm-hmm. subordinates to this and your equipment. It's a dilemma, and I think it's going to start adding up. Or maybe it has added up, and no one's really addressing it yet.
This is real interesting. I've had these discussions with Captain Jenkins, before he retired, and it comes down to the notion of, as these costs go up, I know Kauai County floated some county legislation. I don't think it went through, but it's the dialogue has started of charging people for their rescues. And I know that the Honolulu Sydney County Fire Department fire rescue guys are opposed to that because they don't want anyone to put themselves in greater jeopardy because maybe their credit card's maxed out and they can't afford $1,000 an hour helicopter ride out of the mountains. But one of the things that makes sense to me, mm-hmm. and because we're looking at what are the deterrents? If I don't have staff at each one of these illegal trails saying don't go there, or the fire department doesn't have this unlimited budget, but the one thing is that, these entitled people are risking the lives of firemen who have families. Mm-hmm. And so they're putting themselves at risk. Like the Pali Notches is one of those places. They have to exit our park, go up to the notches, and that is increasing in the need for rescue. And that's what they call a high-angle rescue because it's a steep slope. So one of the things that makes sense to me, and I don't, not being in the fire rescue business, I understand this moral dilemma of should we charge people, but it makes sense to charge somebody if they go in an area where it's posted that it's closed.
Yeah.
If at Diamond Head, that's a managed facility, okay. We assume the cost collectively of because we're encouraging people to go there. But if we're not only not encouraging them, but we're saying it's kapu, don't even go here. I think the sign should also include, if you get rescued, here's what the hourly fee would be. And that one is starting to gain amongst policy and lawmakers maybe a little bit more traction than it did several years ago. But there has to be a balance for the fire rescue guys when if they're going to jeopardize their life, then and their budget's going to be whacked more and more. And you came up with a really good point, John, and that is what are they not getting to do because they have to go save somebody who's not getting service because they have to go get this other person who's trespassing. So mm-hmm. those are things that may evolve as this trend, if it continues. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's an observation that I like to make. When they fly this helicopter, and this tremendous cost, it usually has a tanker truck with it or tender truck, and then it's usually got a police officer. So all those resources. But if I'm driving down the street and I'm texting, and I run over a pedestrian, I'm held accountable for that. And if I take a drink and drive, I'm held accountable for that action.
Yeah.
And then I'm penalized and could be prosecuted. So I believe that if you put yourself in danger, well, that's one way to look at it, but then you're exposing other officers. So why not charge you mm-hmm. if you are that reckless? And then I think it would each occasion would you'd have to assess each one, but
sure.
the city prosecutor or whoever should be dealing with it that way, because when you leave and you walk past a sign, all the elements and the prima facie evidence is there suggesting that you were well informed, you knew that it wasn't, you're sneaking in at 2:00 in the morning.
Exactly.
Or you park your car over in Kaneohe side and then you sneak up to the Stairway to Heaven and then you come back out through Pearl, what's that, Kalihi Valley side.
Oh, over on Moanalua Garden side.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when you go through that duration to do that, I think you should be criminally held accountable.
And then you forgot to mention, decide to sue somebody when you're all done.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't believe that person actually has the mindset. Yeah. And what are you aware of this guy that is suing the homeowner because he injured himself trespassing on his property at 2:00 a.m. to get to Haiku Stairs?
No, please tell us about that.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
I heard bits and pieces, but I don't know. But if you could, just
I don't know the full story. I don't know, Micah, if you guys know more, but it's pretty much that. You know, the guy, from what I'd heard, his vacation itinerary was primarily based on I'm going up the stairway to heaven, and so that was his mission for coming to the state. And you know, he knew because social media tells you all the things you need to know about how to avoid any county law enforcement at the bottom or whatever, and there's various routes you can take. And apparently he, in going over a fence to trespass over through some guy's yard to get to the way up to the haiku stairs, he fell, or the guy had some kind of stuff that was, I guess, injurious to people in some way, and he fell and he hurt himself. And he's suing the homeowner for his injury. And to me, that's like the most humongous sense of entitlement ever. It's like not only are you trespassing, but you're going to sue the guy who is just trying to keep people out of his yard.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's an interesting moral and legal situation at this point.
So where does a property owner come into play? I mean, a lot of it involves federal government property. But here this person is exposed, the homeowner.
Yeah.
Back of my house, down in the canyon, there's these military bunkers, and people were eager to go down in there. Always, someone's trying to explore old military sites, the old munitions storage area, and at midnight you see people crawling out of there, sneaking out of there, or it was when there were cows or cattle being held in there. There was a tendency of mushroom hunters.
Oh God!
And they didn't care. Who
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't understand.
They didn't care whose fence they went over or whose driveway they had mushrooms on their mind. And so now it's selfie on their mind. That is really,
for me, it's a lack of education now. For all this can be so avoidable if the education gets out there from people, maybe organizations that own the land, companies that own this land. We got to put it out there for the public and the tourists.
How do you do that, though, when it's in social media? It's like, and these are flash in the pan. Today it's Instagram,
and
next month it's going to be Facebook.
Right. Facebook is only old people now,
Yeah.
And that's the advantage that you have, where they're using social media to go on and find these sites. We can also use social media
to combat it or inform
and start educating people on what not to do or where to go.
There's software,
so you can use it against them in a way. Would be beneficial to HFD hanging off a helicopter. It's all avoidable. People just got to learn to know your limits. And I think that's the picture that they see on that social media site, is kind of fogging out their vision of their limits and stuff like that.
You're listening to the Carol Cox Show. My guest here is Mr. Kurt Cottrell, the administrator for the state parks, Michael and Jonathan Dawn, and Mr. John Ave.
You'll get it right by the end.
Ave, no more.
And the letter Y.
Oh,
just look behind you on that. It sounds like that.
K-W-A-I. Y.
Why?
Okay. Anyway, this is a dilemma, and I think it's growing to be worse, because I'm looking back on this young lady, and I don't want to make fun of her, because she is. But if you'd have just seen her fingernails.
Oh.
They were some of the most intricate design, and I'm thinking, you don't need to even leave the dusty trail. You're not made for hiking. You're going to go up the Cocoa Head, and you're going to go up the backside, and you're alone. And I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking, my goodness, Kurt and John, those guys are really onto something here. This is right in living flesh, living color, confirming the worst.
Yeah.
It's a nightmare playing out.
Yeah. Going back to social media, education, that's really, it's key. And we had a big meeting, departmental meeting a while back, and we met with the folks from Oracle. And it's the old saying, you got to fight fire with fire. And I know no one's really looking at my state park website, except maybe old people now.
Yeah.
You know, millennials are, and the Yelp, the, you know, the Twitter, Instagram, all that. But there is software. You know, there's a price tag to it, but, you know, we're looking at, you can purchase software and you can program it to do all kinds of things. And Oracle, and there's probably a few other companies, you could put in, you know, keywords.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I guess, like a robot thing. It will troll through
search
the internet,
alert. Okay.
Search and alert. And data is now, I think, the most valuable commodity, you know, on the face of the earth. Whoever controls data, like that's Facebook. You know, they're going to own the world because they know everything about everybody. But the beauty of the software that really appealed to me is not only would you collect all this information as all these sites that say, you know, say Putumayamana, you know, mm-hmm. hiking Putumayamana, and now we have like 9,000 bits of data. You still need a human to kind of sort through it. But here's the good part is it will, you could send messages to all of the things that it finds on the internet.
Listing that site, Putumayamana.
Right. And with your own message saying, be advised, this is closed, it's dangerous. You know, you could be subject to, you know, criminal or civil penalties if you're cited. We haven't gotten to that level yet in terms of, you know, trying to figure out if we could afford the software.
What is a cost like that, rough estimate?
It's like not off the charts. It's like $40,000 to get it set up, and then there's some kind of a maintenance fee. But
is that all? I mean, in one lawsuit.
I know. Well, there
just an attorney fees for the state.
Oh, I know. But there's some other, I can't remember all the exact costs, but the hard part is you need a body. You need someone, you need to hire somebody or create a position that now looks at the data.
The HTA listens to my show, and they should be kind enough to fund that.
Actually, they are.
And they should be eager to, because it's something that's building.
HTA is working with our department right now to come up with a position.
Great.
And fund it out of their budget that just trolls social media for us. So,
and how about on the airplanes coming, like we did the agricultural, no frogs in the basket, alien species prevention. This would
That's
be
a good point.
Putting on the airplanes a simple, it won't be offensive, it's just saying, hey, if you go up here, did you know that this is dangerous? I mean, and spell it out. That's why I was going to say to you that article.
Mm-hmm.
HCTA should try to get permission to use that, and just be realistic. Show the number of people and the injured.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one of the biggest challenges we've had with being community outreach, dealing with people in the community as visitors as well. And a lot of example is like, people swimming with the dolphins or illegal activities, going on illegal hikes. When we ask them, how did they find out about it? A lot of them are telling us, the person at Aulani or the person at the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just thinking, okay, we got to get in touch with these hotels and whatnot. But then you go and you contact one hotel and then another one pops up or another travel agency pops up. And it's just to keep up with them, it's just like if you could get somebody like the HTA who encompasses all of it to helping the process, I'm sure it would make a huge difference,
I don't want to make trouble, but I ask it publicly. Isn't this
present? Wait, you don't want to make trouble?
Yeah, Carol? No. But no, never. Never.
I'm shocked.
But I just don't want anybody to fall from the cliff.
Oh, okay.
What happens here is that it needs to be addressed. It really, playing around with it, it's going to cost the taxpayer money anyway.
Yeah.
And HTA can't, they don't have all the answers, but here's the problem. Are we willing to say and understand that there's a carrying capacity there to
Ooh.
Some point?
Ooh.
There is a, are we willing to approach, is part of the solution to say the number of people coming here, the capacity that it's exceeding
mm-hmm.
now.
Yeah.
Before it had a normal level of capacity, manageable. Now it's exceeding that. What is that level? And then who's willing to say, because the more people you invite,
mm-hmm.
there's a greater demand for more activity. And so our resource is going to be impacted whether we
We're not, because if we get, what, 9 million a year now?
We're over 9, record numbers. And then projected 10 in like the next couple
of years. And we're still vigorously soliciting more to come.
Yeah.
So now imagine the impacts that are the unforeseeable or the foreseeable ones that are presenting themselves.
Yeah. That's a really... That subject right now is one of the key discussions at the legislature. Mm-hmm. There's been legislation introduced this year that indicates if we reach a threshold of, say, 10, and this is a sensitive subject, there's a delicate balance between HTA and the visitor industry and those of us on the receiving end that manage the resources mm-hmm. that they're promoting. And if you look at the visitor industry marketing stuff, a lot of it shows all the beautiful state parks. That's the backdrop. And yet, I have a managing budget for the whole state park system of $12 million. That's okay. All I have for 52 parks, 125 employees. The marketing budget just for the Tourism Authority is $82 million, just to promote the state. Now, I understand and support we need tourists. That's part of, our economy. But I think we've reached a point where we're addicted. It's mm-hmm. like tourism is a drug for the state where we – and Carol, I'm really glad you brought up the notion of limits, because I don't know how you would legally
– Right. That was my next statement.
Right.
How do you
when you say we're full, right?
Maybe for foreigners you could do that, but imagine the back wash on that one.
Right. But we do have control. It's kind of like, do you ever see – and I don't know if I'm allowed to say stuff like this on the radio, but do you ever see Starbucks ads on television? They don't have to market, right? They're kind of solid. I would argue that there's two things happening. A, Hawaii is globally recognized as a destination for all this stuff. And the discussion at the legislature is, and there's bills right now in play, do we still need to spend as much money as we do to promote and market the state as we have in the past? And I've also added to the discussion back to the social media thing and Yelp and those other sites, a lot of the marketing is being done for us at no cost
mm-hmm.
through social media.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's a delicate discussion at the ledge because, I don't do, the market economy stuff. It's not in my wheelhouse. So I understand if you diminish the marketing budget and you repurpose those funds and say some of it comes to parks and Na'alehele and our Division of Aquatic Resources or, those places that are dealing with the impacts, but then tourism drops, then the question is, do you take the money back away from the resources
mm-hmm.
and put it back in? And shoot, that's like it's like going to Vegas. You just don't know, what it's going to do. But that's the discussion right now on the policymaker level going, okay, if we can't establish a limit because it's just either impossible to enforce or illegal or immoral or whatever, you can limit how much money we spend on promotion.
Yeah. Well, I think it's going to have to be a convening of all of the heads, your agency, the fire department, because here's the trick. In the global economy now, I believe that even if we didn't bother to solicit people or advertise for people coming here, people, as you say, Hawaii is on the list of places to go. Mm-hmm. And then consider world issues and all of that. This seems to be a safe place. And
yeah.
So I believe that it's going to get worse even if we were to come up with the best design from HTA and a relationship in the fire department. So it behooves us to really start thinking real fast and try to manage what's within our control, because there is. I saw people yesterday. They're at Lanai Lookout.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a sign that says, "Do not go beyond this."
Our guys put up that sign.
Yeah, do not go beyond this point. It's in. You can't miss it. To get there, you can bang your head.
Right. That was the intention. Signs kind of in the way.
And here are people with their kids, a gaggle of kids, little 3-4-year-old kids. One lady's carrying a baby. Do you know walking down that slope is as deadly as a chance as anything you could engage in?
Yeah.
And they're going all the way down to the waves.
Yeah.
And one lady said, oh, this is where Obama buried his mother's, or someone spread his ashes. We want to go down there and take a picture with that. And the waves are just pounding us there at that point. And I'm thinking, oh, but what right do you have to, you just,
yeah.
You just like, well, I'll stand here and call 911 if I see. And I've been there mm-hmm. on that point where there have been a many a 911 helicopter or lifeguard when it's thrashing.
Mm-hmm.
So what about that land bridge over there? That is, we've known there below Hanama Bay.
Oh, yeah.
I noticed that
I've never been there, so I can't.
I noticed people sneak in on the back coming up to Hanama Bay before you go in, turn in. There's a trail that goes up through the antennas, or apparently. And the people that I see walking there yesterday, little kids and families, just, and it's like, something's going to have to give, because these people are exposing themselves to these dangers.
Well, and then what happens? You get a lawsuit, and then it costs even more money, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've seen children, parents take their newborn babies on these cliff, rock climbing hikes and whatnot, and they can come down and say, well, there was no signs telling us the danger and whatnot.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. It makes me, piggybacking on what you guys are talking about with the tourism authority, and it's kind of like, taking care of your product, right? Like anything in the hospitality.
Oh, good point.
It's kind of like, or like a taxi driver. If he doesn't use the money to, keep his car maintained or mm-hmm. keep it clean, nobody's going to want to use his service, or a hotel room. Nobody wants to stay in a hotel room, which is a dump. And, all this advertising, it's to the point where we speak to tourists that actually get out to these places, and it's, from my perspective, it's almost like false advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the videos from the drone or whatever, you don't get to see firsthand the poop in the bushes. And, a lot of these, the responses when we're out there cleaning the community from these tourists, they basically say, oh, back home where we are, oh, you get fined for this. Or
right,
or they have this,
we'll fine you here too.
And we figure, a place like, they say, a place as beautiful as Hawaii, you figure there would be more funds being put into the protection and preservation of it.
Yeah.
So to me, it's kind of like you have a product you got to take care of in order for your business to prosper and continue in the future. If you don't, then, you're just making as much money as you can until the thing is destroyed.
Okay.
That's exactly right. Micah just nailed it. Reinvestment mm-hmm. in the resource.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Good point.
It's like the dolphin chasers. They don't care if they drive the dolphins away from the bay. Just make as much money as you can.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about that in the next hour, and there's quite a bit you have. I'd love to talk about state parks and the fragility of it. Just take, for example, Kaina Point, where that must be a nightmare trying to manage that. With the people, and we want people to see our resources and enjoy and benefit from them, but what impacts are they really having? So we'll be back, and the number is 888-5204. This is the Carol Cox Show. We'll be back shortly.
For the second half of the Carol Cox Show. We'll be right back. It's time for the Carol Cox Show right here at K108. If you have questions or comments for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080. And now, here's Carol.
Okay. Hey, good morning and welcome back to the Carol Cox Show right here at KWAI 1080 AM. We are happy to have Mr. Kurt Cottrell, Administrator for the State Parks, Hawaii State Parks, of the Department of Land and Natural Resources, Micah Jonathan Dawn, and Mr. John Y.
There you go.
I don't know why I want to call you Ave, but for some reason. But what we're doing is tossing around some concerns with social media and its impacts and the how people are finding themselves in precarious situations and dangerous situations, life-threatening or bodily harm or what have you, by looking at social media. And we're trying to just discuss its impact, its influence on people and our tourists and what have you. What percentage would you guys say is locals rely on the social media to find these sites? Is it a big problem? We didn't have this problem before, but then we didn't have social media.
Here, I think there's been some, you know, a question I had asked before was, before social media, what beaches did everyone go to? Because now it seems like everyone ends up at the beaches that no one went to. So even people before our good friend, because we grew up going, our favorite beach was, you know, Makua and the shore break over there. But his parents wouldn't take him there because they were afraid of the area. And there was people living on the beach. They didn't know him or whatever. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of people that didn't want to go down there because of the stigma of the side of different areas. Now with social media, it seems like those threatening aspects or whatever that may have prevented people from going to places before, now it's just more comfortable and they feel free to go to places. And that's the way it should be. But at the same time, just because you feel comfortable, that doesn't mean it's a free-for-all.
Right.
You know, you got to still take into consideration, you know, what you're doing and the effects that it has on the places.
I think it's as many residents as it is visitors going to social media. I know, like, my daughters and my older daughter is, like, does all the stuff I say you shouldn't do when I'm on the radio saying you shouldn't do it. And I've scolded her. I said, so what is your story if you get rescued? She goes, I'm going to say that my father always told me not to go. And
And then the question is, who's your father?
Right. Well, that's what I mean. It's like, how are you going to cover dad's okole, right, you know? But I think as much, you know, residents as there are visitors, I think everybody, you know, that wants to get outdoors. And as a recreation manager, I mean, I manage state parks, you know, because I really love our state parks. I'm fortunate enough to be in a position where I have stewardship, and my kuleana is all these awesome resources. So I love people to see them, and I love people to get out and experience them. We just weren't prepared for the numbers of people loving the parks to death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are some of the things, cultural sites or petroglyphs or what have you? I've seen people do rubbings and what have you.
Yeah.
Do you have any objections to that, or is there any downside to that? I mean, one might say, well, I'm just taking a pencil and a crayon and scratching over it. But what do you?
Well, there's two impacts. There's the fundamental impact to a cultural site because of the sanctity of the cultural site and just being there with a certain frame of mind or to exploit it is wrong. And then there's the impact to the site itself in terms of rocks, you know, getting knocked over and whatnot. But, you know, here's a good example that, like, we manage Ke'iwa Heiau, Aiea Loop, right?
Right.
And, you know, that's a medicinal heiau. And our park is kind of positioned around it. We allow camping, and then, you know, we get people wanting to get permits to do, like, say, weddings in the heiau, and we're like, no, you can't use the heiau for that. Or we go up there, and people have left little trinket beads on the rocks, or they do what we call the rock lau lau, where they take a rock and they wrap a tea leaf around it.
Right.
And I don't know where they got the notion that, you know, our host culture's deities, you know, wanted rocks with tea leaves, because typically the offering was food. You know, and so, but every time someone does that, it you know, one person, not a big deal, but in large numbers, it has an impact on both the feeling you get at, like, say, this medicinal heao, or it physically starts eroding, you know, the heao itself. So, you know, that is a really, you know, tricky metrics for us to try to manage. Again, what would solve it for us is people. That we are, we have staffed people at these sites that give interpretive information, but also tell you what's appropriate, what's inappropriate. It's like, here's a good example. I have 125 employees, myself included, for the entire Hawaii State Park system of 52 state parks. Haleakala National Park on Maui has 78 employees just for that one park unit. And the federal government, through the National Park Service, has, with their resources, they recognize the value and they staff them up with people. They have rangers and, and whatnot. We just say, e como mai, and we have places like, you know, Ka'iwi with these, you know, tide pools down below that years ago nobody went to. Now, every weekend, these tide pools are just loaded with people. And we've had deaths at these tide pools from waves. Places like that needs a person that works for government that has information on either the cultural sensitivity of the site or the natural resource value, and then tells people when it's inappropriate to be there. You know, and that's what things we've been saying at the legislature is, you know, we're promoting these beautiful images, and then, you know, we get complaints like at Puho'ulaka'a up at Round Top where the view is awesome, but the person comes back and their car was popped, you know, and all of their belongings were taken. And they go to the bathroom, and the bathroom, you know, all the toilet paper's gone or whatever. And it's that false advertising that Mike was talking about. The view is what we're advertising, but they never turn the camera around to look at the infrastructure and how bus up it is to get people to that view.
And quite naturally, this Facebook or social media posting would have brought people there more than you had prepared for, and just in something as simple as leaving the toiletries or to adequately cover the normal use.
What was anticipated when we did the plan for the park at the time, and here's another real good example. It's not my feature, but Manawili Falls is a really good example. Back in, I want to say, 1983, when the first golf course was being put in there, there was a provision that mandated that the golf course allow for access to Manawili Falls. And back at that time period, everyone knew that the access to Manawili Falls that they were providing for was for local residents, pretty much kids in the summer, to go swimming. Mm-hmm. So there was no infrastructure ever put in. The trail was you know, kind of just a social trail, never really been developed. No parking, no bathrooms. And then the visitor industry and the visitors themselves, one of the big things they want is a waterfall. You know, that's part of the mindset of coming to Hawaii. And the residents of the Manawili Estate subdivision are, like, what they're dealing with Haiku Stairs, just tour buses and hordes of people. And the trail went from a small trail to just a big mud bog because the law to provide access, nobody envisioned that it would become a global access. And that's what the social media thing has done. All these little access points that go through neighborhoods to protect, you know, either cultural rights to access to the land or just to provide what at the time was a medium amount of public recreation have exploded with the visit. That's what happened to Mariner's Ridge, which was owned by Kamehameha Schools. They had to close it because back in the day, you know, just local, you know, residents would use Mariner's Ridge. But there's a, you know, a whole subdivision of people that live, you know, right at the base of that trail. And what happened when the visitors discovered it in the small fly-by-night tour operators, you know, that people would go in and, you know, use their water from their hoses and wipe their muddy feet on their yards, and the people just went, oh my, you know, it was, you know, and again, it's just bad behavior in large numbers, and it's not malicious, it's just people are ignorant.
Right. So, well, we have a call. You want to take the call and see?
Sure.
Caller, thank you for calling. You have a comment or question?
Yeah, I listened in and I couldn't get back because I was some other business. But this required, let me turn.
He got his radio on.
Oh.
It regards the news on the Lanikai pillbox, which had all this graffiti painted on it. I heard you mention that. Now, isn't that a historical site, and why? And I think that they want to keep those the graffiti on this pillbox. What is the situation with that?
I can speak a little. I know I used to run the Na'alehele program, and that trail was, you know, came under our jurisdiction. And you're absolutely right. It's a historic feature. All of the military, you know, pillboxes and gunnery emplacements and all those, they're over 50 years old, so they all qualify as historic features. And I know there's a lot of plans right now with that program to now come up with ways of trying to manage what the future is. And they are doing some improvements now, and they're trying to, I think, stabilize the pillbox because it was getting degraded from all the people going and sitting on it. I don't quite know what the situation is with their graffiti. The assumption is that it would be restored and, you know, painted over. But I don't know quite what the plans are. But that's a great example of the folks that live at the bottom of that trail are up in arms because of the impact of people parking all over the place, you know, and going up the trail. Again, people go up there for sunrise, they go up there for moonrise, so it's not just standard 9-to-5 hiking. It's, you know, all hours of the morning and night now, people going up there. So,
well, my question is that I sat on the maybe KHON News last night. It seems like there's been a movement by people to not paint it over because a lot of people put their names and dates and other information on it, and it's totally painted over. I don't know if you saw that news article.
No, I didn't.
And so it looked like there's a movement to keep the graffiti on there. I've never heard that before, where people want to keep graffiti on what could be historical site, such as this pillbox. I don't know about the Diamond Head pillbox. I don't know if that has graffiti on it.
No, we at State Parks...
Keep that clean because of tourists.
No. At State Parks, you know, we manage all of our historic features to try to maintain their integrity. So when we get graffiti on our pillboxes, like up at Kaivi and whatnot, we... Eventually, you know, because we're short staff, we get our crews up and we, you know, we at least try to paint it a neutral color to restore the integrity. But I'm not aware of a movement within government to just let the graffiti stay.
No, it's not a government. I think it's a movement by people who paint the pillbox, don't want the government to paint it over.
Oh, that is exactly true. And Micah can talk about that a bit. But, yeah, the general public doesn't want the government to restore it.
Yeah, I know there's certain
they want it to stay there, but I think it's an insult.
I agree.
To the pillbox of the history of World War II. So, you know, that's all I have to say.
Yeah. Well, no, thanks for the comment.
To see what comes out of it in the news meter.
What you're saying is exactly what we're talking about. People feel they have the entitled issue to not only go where they want, but to leave their mark on something that it really, the sanctity of the historic part of it is destroyed.
Right. Well, I don't think they should be painting even buildings, but this is more of a historical site. That's all I have to say. Thank you for listening. No. Bye-bye.
Leave only footprints and take only photographs.
There you go. Or I guess period. Take only selfies.
Yeah, take only selfies.
But take them safely.
Yeah, we got another call here. Caller, thank you for calling. You have a comment or question?
Yes, it's great to have you guys talking about this. I have noticed, though, whenever I leave Hawaii, and I try not to leave, but I fly back in, so people are either flying into Hawaii or they're coming on ships. My idea has always been, why is there not videos that people on these airplanes are mandated to watch saying that, look, when you come to Hawaii, you could even make it like it's a news bulletin and kind of show people being rescued and say, look, when you come to Hawaii, don't be an idiot. We don't want to have to rescue you, you know. Don't walk on people's lawns as you access the beaches, and don't do all the things that you gentlemen are talking about this morning, on planes and as well as ships coming into the, to the state.
Yep.
That is, that's the goose that lays the golden egg in terms of, how to try to prevent this behavior. And you're absolutely right. It's really hard. I've tried in my previous position to try to crack that nut with the airline industry, and because we have all that time spent of teachable moments for these visitors, and you know, the only thing I can say as to why we haven't been successful is that typically, other than the agricultural related information about what pests can do to Hawaii's unique environment, there's a trend where they don't want to say anything negative. Typically on the airlines, it's always still about what you can see and what you can do, and there's a tendency to not want to educate the tourist, as I would call it, versus alarm them that there's danger or some kind of bad thing that can happen. But I think based on this pressure, that's going to change, because as we're talking about this morning, as we're struggling for ways to, if we can't stop or reduce or maintain the visitors that are coming in the certain numbers, the only thing we can try to do is raise their consciousness and awareness before they get in. And you're absolutely right. The airline in particular is the prime teachable time for us to get these messages. And there's a way to do it where it's not alarming, but educational. So I'm hoping that the folks who manage our promotional parts of our visitor industry are listening and pay attention to this, because if we're going to keep bringing people in, we got to bring in better informed people, and that's the best opportunity. So you're absolutely right. It's a great question.
Yeah, because it can be crafted tastefully, and you do something to bring an impact, so people look up and say, hey, well, what are they talking about?
Yeah.
And then you say lovingly, we love you, tourists. We want you to come here, but look, seriously, you really got to be safe when you come here, because we're not here in Hawaii trying to have tourists get injured and maimed.
Exactly.
So there's a way it can be crafted, and not only the airlines, but also the ships that come in.
Sure. No, you're up. It could be the same message to both groups, and then you just come up with how many different languages, because that is the other challenging part, because you got folks coming from the west and folks coming from the east, and so you got to tailor the messages to the groups that are coming in. But no, I think it's the future. Is that's going to be something that the visitor industry has to do, because as Micah said earlier, if we start getting a reputation of our, you come here and the sites are there's hostility, say, from communities and whatnot because of these impacts. If we get the people to behave more responsibly, then because our biggest thing that we market is our aloha. It's the people that are here. And I can tell you from the community meetings I've been to where I have features that are bringing in more visitors, there's a bigger pushback now from local communities on visitors than there ever has been before, because there's no boundaries anymore.
Okay.
So, but thank you.
All right, well, you guys are on the right track.
Right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Talk to you later. Aloha.
Here are some observations that I've made in the last 4 months, 5 months. Take Ali'i Beach. Here's where we're seeing impacts just present themselves overnight, almost in a sense. And that is, small tour companies are structuring such programs where they have a bus, they go to the hotel, and somehow they become the conduit, and they take these people and thrust them out at Ali'i Beach, Haleiwa Beach, and that impact is immediately, and there's no preparation. The state agencies, the city agencies that are just caught off guard with this. And then the downside of that is that you see the people, the tour guides themselves, and they're herding the turtles, and people grabbing the sea turtles. There's a great many sea turtles there at Ali'i Beach, and they crawl out on the sand.
And I don't know, that's a, it's been kind of a quiet community thing. But now all of a sudden, the impact, because people want to see turtles, and I appreciate that, because it later on when there's money needed to be spent, they won't object. They'll say, oh, I love the turtles, and spend some money to protect them, hopefully. But Ali'i Beach and Haleiwa Beach has been a perfect example of where things can go wrong and all the components that make them go wrong. Mm-hmm. And I would say, the reason I raise that issue is that the tour guide is responsible.
Yes.
And maybe we should also have them, if you're going to be required, you know. Mm-hmm. And your impacts, when you're bringing people there and making money, the restrooms and all, there should be a license. Honestly, I don't believe
absolutely
in being taxed, but this is a business that's creating an impact that is noticeable in an instant. And so the bathrooms at the city park there at the Haleiwa, you're overwhelmed now.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't anticipated, wasn't planned for, wasn't budgeted for, but it's an instant problem presented.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't be shy about, the legislators and the city council shouldn't be shy about seeking to tax or require a natural resource tag for a ticket or license for that particular commercial fisherman. They take fish.
Yeah.
They have to have a commercial license.
Right, right.
But how about a commercial license for businesses?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that might offset some of the costs. They can pay someone to clean the bathrooms, and you won't walk in there and no toilet tissue, and you don't have the man hours, the manpower dedicated to that from a state sense. But speaking of all of that, I see you got something to say about that.
You just hit on something, and Micah, you know, has stuff to say about that in terms of impact to dolphins. But we've been talking about social media. The other thing that's happened is, and we see it at state parks, used to be there were tour companies that had like an office. And they had their facilities and they had their buses and whatnot. But like the Airbnbs, the commercial tour industry now is digital, and you know, you don't need a brick and mortar office anymore. You can just have your vehicle from wherever and have knowledge of the places that, you know, the visitor wants to go to, and they're pimping them out in greater numbers. And you, Carol, your point is spot on in that the taxpayers subsidizing the cost of their impact by the impact of the public resources.
Right.
You know, I'm deploying more people to go to restrooms that before didn't get this additional load of commercial tour folks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's impacting both the community, the resource, and then in like in the case off the west side, because the visitor wants to swim with dolphins, it's bringing, you know, these entrepreneurs are coming out and going, I will get you there. And and they're not paying any rent because they don't have a office or
fixed office.
Yeah. And they're just taking in the income. And at parks, we're working on trying to figure out a way to we know who some of these companies are, and as soon as we see them on the internet, we send them a message going, you know, without a permit you can't conduct your commercial activity.
Oh, you're actually pursuing that now?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh,
we
good.
But I mean, there's so many of them and there's so few of us. I mean, it's a drop in the bucket, but we're looking at trying to come up with a ways where we identify them all, and then the problem is, though, is some of them, we don't want them to do it. It's not like we want to give them a permit and collect money.
Right.
We just don't want you to do it because it's just not right.
The impact is just too substantial.
Exactly. Or if we let them do it, here's the quandary. Legally, it's like, well, if I let one guy do it, then the next 20 people that want to do it, theoretically, they should get a permit.
You have to, because you've set precedent.
Precisely. So then it comes down to, I need to figure out a way where we set a capacity, which I did with the Na'alahele program. We came up with numbers of people. But for parks, the problem is moving faster than we can respond to it. That's really the bottom line. But you're right. They're impacting resources and staff time. And they're profiting from it, and that's
and
wrong.
Then having an impact that we didn't anticipate. We anticipated, but not in a sudden sense, like instant. Talking about Instagram, this is instant results.
Instacash.
Yeah, so the question is, with the legislative process right now, it's in session, what bills are you mentioned earlier, some beneficial bills, what bills are there, and maybe the public, I know you can't advocate for public awareness, but just let us know, and maybe some of the listeners out there would be willing to call and encourage our legislators to help out.
I would, without calling out specific, you know, bill numbers and whatnot, one of the biggest problems we have at the legislature as a government entity advocating for, like, say, more positions at Makua to take care of the place or any of our parks, is that we usually hear the people grumbling when things are going wrong to us, but we never see those grumblers advocate to the legislature that deal in our resources, state parks needs more capacity. And so I would just encourage anybody that cares about their natural and cultural resources and the quality of management to advocate to their legislature anything you can do to enrich how state parks, you know, using my division as an example, to do their job better, we're in strong support of. And here's a good example we looked at. We have 8,000 permittees that have permits to drive their vehicles at Ka'ena Point.
8,000.
When we first set up that program, we anticipated maybe 3,000 trucks and four-wheel drive. Well, it's up to 8,000. So there's a constituency for us right now of 8,000 people that if we had some form of legislation, say it was directed at improving the conditions and protecting the resource at Ka'ena, we could say, hey, 8,000 of you that go out there, if you want to see this place get better, contact your senators and reps. And so with our data now that we're starting to collect, that's the upside of permitting. I don't like to do it. We do it because we have to. Mm-hmm. But now all these people using some of these resources, we do the same thing at Kealakekua. We have email addresses, and we know who they are. And we can say, hey, you know, we need support here, here, and here. So, but it's really just anything to enrich the capacity of management. So we're more balanced with what the marketing budget is.
Your use and visitation of these areas has an impact.
Yeah.
And therefore, to offset that, you know, we need a continuous courting of the legislative process, the managers and the governor or whomever. Yeah. Let them know that you support spending money, that it's not something frivolous.
Exactly.
That you benefit from this.
Right.
And I look at Ka'ena Point and I think the nightmare. I remember going out there with Betsy Gagne and others and cutting trees, the alien species, and moving them and blocking off trails now. And then there's an array of ropes and things now. Mm-hmm. But you go out there, it's kind of sad. You don't really want to go out there from my standpoint, because you see every time you go there, there's somebody. Got to get that selfie with the albatross.
Yeah.
I saw one person attempting to hug the albatross, and I thought, come on. You know, I was going to call him bird brain, and I thought I might offend the bird.
It would have. That's an insult to the albatross.
No, but he was telling his wife, here, honey, take the picture.
That's the best one I heard.
Yeah.
But, you know, you don't want to insult an albatross. I mean, no, they're majestic birds, right?
Kind of going off what Kurt was saying a little bit, you know, and just about the people, you know, having the power within themselves, too. You know, a lot of times on social media, right, wherever you go, you hear people complaining about government and how the people have no say. Mm-hmm. And the government just takes total control and doesn't listen to the people. Well, you know, you can only say that if you've, exhausted all your means of trying to contact the government or, you know, get in touch with them, because what I've experienced, you know, when I first started calling the state parks and stuff, I'm a clear example, you know. I didn't know what was going on. I'm figuring, hey, why aren't they doing this? What's going on? And then, you know, the more you get involved, the more you learn, the more you realize who's doing what, who's not doing what. You realize that, hey, they're doing everything they can within their capacity. The reason why there might be limitations, I got to go talk to somebody else, maybe a representative or a politician, to say, hey, can we get help for this matter? Until people start getting more involved, going to neighborhood board meetings, contacting their reps, then they won't get the clear information on what's really going on. Mm-hmm. And what I see with people is they just go based on what's being told, you know, kind of mainstream, and a lot of stuff isn't being blasted out there, because, you know, living in a place like Hawaii, it's so small, and, you know, sometimes you want to just put somebody on blast, but then, you know, you become
you know, your human side says, you know, there's got to be a more positive way to go about this. But it seems like some people, unless they're held accountable, will just keep realizing that, you know, it's okay. For example, I don't want to mention any names, but I got texted about a bill that was, you know, being submitted a while ago, and, you know, the response was like the testimonies weren't even heard.
Oh, really?
And, you know, the concerns were mentioned, and the response was, well, it's been some time now since that's been aired. Do you think the people would feel different about it now? And so my response to that was just like, well, you got to be involved with the community, and the community's got to be involved with, you know, the representatives. And it seems like there's this total lack of communication, because the community is being told one thing, you know. Mm-hmm. These things aren't necessarily the total accurate information, and the people are just basing their judgment based on that. And, you know, I mean, Kurt and, you know, Alan from State Parks had actually been out there with us, you know, blood, sweat, and, you know, in the brush clearing out rubbish. You know, I haven't seen that from...
So your organization, the Protectors of Paradise, right? And you work now with informally with the state parks on many projects, right?
No, they actually have a adopt a park agreement.
Oh, you got that already?
Yeah.
All right, you work fast, man. He said I'm trying to get Kirk intoxicated. I got what's the best, you know, kind of liquor to
get? Well, I just looked at it as the rate. You know, the rate that things were being destroyed. It's like in the emergency room. Like Kurt has used it as an example before. It's like figured, hey, if you don't do something now, the way that people were going, like, you know, every weekend, like a scene out of Mad Max. It's just like these places that we hold, you know, so valuable would just be gone.
You know? It's funny. Like, I met Micah, a couple years ago now, yeah? And our first conversations we had on the phone were very heated. I was an anonymous government dude, you know.
Sorry about that.
It's all right. And, you know, we had some really spirited dialogue about, you know, what can and cannot happen at Makua. But, you know, one of the things that really helps us is I get lots of calls from people that say they want to do stuff, but they typically want something in return, some special privilege, some special access. And so I have to take each one of these interactions with a grain of salt. But with Micah, you know, and his brother and JR and the Protectors of Paradise, when I saw that they actually walked the walk,
right,
and I saw the pounds of nails that they would pick up from the pallet fires in their trucks with their own money, you know, on their own time picking up, you know, diapers and broken coolers and bottles and all the rubbish from the Halekoa at Makua, I went, wow, you know, these guys actually, you know, do what we don't have the capacity to do. And so it went from, you know, essentially I'm the government, he's the outside, why are we not doing our job, to where we formed this really good partnership, and to the point where, you know, Micah is also part of the Ahamoku, which is a really important program that started several years ago, where we work with direct lineal descendants of the areas that we're in charge of. And since Micah's the Ahamoku rep for Makua, then when I have to do something that is not popular, I guess, with the general public, in which case we stopped the ability for people to camp at Makua, which they've been doing for decades. And when we first allowed camping, you know, Makua was for, like, go there in the summertime and fish with your family and spend several weeks. You know, right. That was, like, back in the day kind. And then it progressed to you go there on a three-day weekend, there's 800 people, there's, you know, trucks and cars all along the beach, there's people having fires, and guess what, folks? There's no bathrooms there. So you can imagine after a three-day weekend what the bushes looked like after after those events. And I have one employee for Makua and Keawe'ula to manage that entire section of coast.
Wow.
I only have
from
one.
Keawe'ula.
From Makua all the way to the Kana Point on the Yokohama or Keawe'ula side, I have one person.
And how many bathrooms?
One.
And so you got the normal, the standard population, and then you had the homeless taxing the resources. But
homeless a little bit, but mainly recreational folks.
Recreational, but now you got the social media visitors.
Yeah, And so when we shut it down, this is the beauty of establishing these kind of partnerships, is because these guys have the ethic of what is the pono or the right or wrong thing to do at Makua. And I had to, you know, hold back on the on people's recreational fun and say, look, Makua is it's the emergency room, it's triage, we gotta let it heal. And these guys had my back though when I had to address the public and community, they're going, this is absolutely right. And so part of the and what I wanted to get to is they use social media and have defended some of the state's actions in terms of what we've had to do. So they're also, besides cleaning it for us and help keeping it clean, they're advocating for the management of the resource, which is huge. Such a big help. We really appreciate, you know, we have other partnerships, but I'd like to make more like this. Yeah.
So how do one get in touch with you, Micah and John? The website, and you're looking for volunteers or muscles or blood, sweat, and tears or plastic bags?
We're talking about social media. That's the easiest way to find us is, on Facebook or Instagram on Protectors of Paradise. If you need to email us, you can also email us at protectorsofparadise@yahoo.com.
And you're a nonprofit, 501c3?
Yeah, we're 501c3.
And you do take donations and what have you?
Take anything.
In kind.
if we're willing to take toilet paper,
No joke. Huh? I mean,
no.
Yeah, because it. That's the other thing. The bathrooms are run down after just a regular use, and then you get overwhelmed. It's no way that bathroom, one bathroom, can take.
Well, that's what I was trying to get at earlier. We reached out, to people in those respected positions to see if we could advocate for funds for these types of, because there's an increase in visitors. But then it seemed like, the responses we were getting were they needed to find money for something else, which wasn't, immediate needs. And so that's the part where I felt like the people really need to be involved, because when they ask us and they say, oh, how come we can't camp at Makua? How come we, what's the DLNR? What are they doing with it? People need to realize that there's a lot more to the situation. If somebody needs to fight for the fund, it needs to be somebody that's out in the community representing them, I would imagine.
So they serve a good purpose.
Yeah.
Well, hold that thought. But I want, if you would, let the public know about state parks.
Sure.
Throughout the state, and how does one get a camping permit? Because a lot of this involves people camping without permits.
Sure.
And give us a rundown on the statewide, some of the sites, and how do they get permits, and who do they call?
Well, the easiest way is to just go to, our website, Hawaii State Parks.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a fully accessible automated camping permit reservation system. You can do it by credit card and whatnot. And the beauty of doing it that way is that it's legal. We're sending you to the authorized place, and we do generate operating cash off the camping permits. We don't charge a lot, but cumulatively, it adds up and helps enrich our budget to manage, cleaning up the campsites and the comfort stations and whatnot. But what we have, state parks, Hawaii State Parks is really unique compared to the other state parks like in the mainland United States, is we've been given the custody and stewardship, kuleana, of 52 features throughout the state that have some of the most spectacular natural resource value, that you can imagine, and some of the most critically important cultural resource value. And it's a tough basket of things to manage, because Kalalau is one of the global tourist destinations for backcountry campers.
Right.
And for years we had a huge amount of illegal campers, and working with our enforcement guys and social media helped us with that, trying to get people to dig out. We've been able to stabilize that and provide more reasonable wilderness camping. But ranging from that to, say, managing the Royal Mausoleum or Mauna Ala up in Nu'uanu, you know, one of the most significant cultural sites in the state, you know, arguably, because it has, you know, the buried royalty in the tombs there. And having to have a budget that can handle both managing these really critical natural resources and preserving, you know, these really important cultural resources is really challenging for us to come up with. We have Iolani Palace, but like with Protectors of Paradise at Makua, we have the Friends of Iolani Palace who actually have a lease, who their income that they generate from tours helps manage places.
And the palace comes under your purview.
It does. Yeah, it's under state parks. And then I have places like Kahana Valley, which is a really challenging situation because we have people actually living in the park. Mm-hmm. And there's challenges in terms of what the expectations are of people living in a park versus what their service should be to be able to be there. And then, you know, you go to places like Kealakekua State Historic Park, where you have everything in one park. You have the place where Captain Cook was you know, taken out. And, you know, off trail in an area that we don't tell where anybody is the emu where they cooked his bones and whatnot, you know, and distributed his stuff. And we keep that, like, we don't want anyone to know about that. And then we have our heiau. We have actually two heiau at Napopo as part of Kealakekua Bay State Historic Park that are really incredibly sensitive heiau structures. And then you have the bay, which is a marine life conservation district, and it has populations of spinner dolphins in there. And we regulate the vessels that come in and out, but we've been, you know, plagued with guys wanting to rent commercial kayak, you know, businesses in there. And something that's just come to my attention, now there's large amounts of swimmers that swim from Napopo to where the dolphins are trying to sleep.
Right.
And it's such an amazing park resource where you have some of our best cultural history and some of our most pristine marine resources.
And fragile and sensitive.
Fragile.
In the core of tangs and the yellow tangs.
All of that,
And I was there watching people do that, swim from the Napopo.
Okay, yeah.
And it's like, oh, God, another way around circumventing the fence. Get around the fence.
Yeah. But it's funny, there's no regs yet in place on proximity to dolphins. There's a dynamic between the federal government, the state government, and NOAA's trying to come up with regulatory stuff like we have with whales on proximity to spinner dolphins. But before that happens, the commercial guys are taking advantage of the opportunity to bring their visitors, you know, to that. So, I mean, I could go on and on about parks that are kind of under siege. Go to Little Beach on Maui, which is next to Makena, which is our state park, and we have raves and illegal drinking and drugs and stuff going on there in the evenings, like on Sunday. And we just don't have enough enforcement or staff capacity to really put people there to prevent those things from starting.
So,
and then once they start, they're really hard to get them to stop.
So having a menace such as, quote, the social media and its problems that it present is really problematic.
It's
just waiting to torch, waiting to set fire to things.
Well, you said something earlier. It's right. It's like over at the beaches with the turtles. It's an overnight. Something can literally explode overnight.
Spring
like,
up,
just like that. Like raves at Makua, we've been able to stop a few of them because they've been promoted on social media. And before the event, somebody informs us, Micah Guys or other folks, and then we send an email out to the site saying, you can't do it, it's illegal, we're going to send law enforcement and whatnot. But the Hawaii State Park system is, I would say right now we're very vulnerable due to our budget right now is so low compared to what the needs are that we're facing. Here's a good example. In 1993, the Hawaii State Park System had an $8 million operating budget, and we had less parks, less people using them, and the behavior was more responsible. You know, back then, tourism was basically designed with buses and control And then the people would get out of the bus, they get back in the bus, and you wouldn't have all these people just...
Right. Right. They pop out of the bus, take a few pictures, and
they were controlled, and they go back to Waikiki, right. and so everything was organized, and now it's just like tourism chaos. Yeah. But if you look at our budget of only $8 million in 93, now here we are in 2018, and in that span of time, over 20 years, our budget has gone from 8 to 12 million. Back in 1993, we had 200 employees. Now we're down to 125. I don't know what our park inventory was, but now we've had other parks, new parks added to our system. And at the same time, we are just saturated with people using it. And so I would say, yeah, the Hawaii State Park system, and again, back to what Micah guys has said, we need to reinvest in the quality of our product.
So Hawaii is... has a caviar taste, but a beer budget.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. So,
bring them on, and we want to showcase the world, the world, and the images here, and the natural resources, and their uniqueness, and the culture.
Yeah.
And then, but,
yeah.
And so here's this one agency, basically, tasked with struggling to protect it all.
Yes.
With... Yeah. So 9 million visitors a day. Back then when your budget was...
No, that was 9 million a year.
9 million a year. But how many were back when you had the 8,000? That'd be interesting.
That'd be a good stat to pull up. I know that it was way less than what we got now.
It wasn't 9 million.
Because we're at 9 million is record numbers. So record numbers of people, way more venues to distribute the information of where to go than we've ever had. And... behavior like what these guys have seen at Makua, where it's not just, you know, families setting up tents and putting up poles. Mm-hmm. It's guys with boom boxes and bringing in bands and, you know, drugs and alcohol and
dressed up as animals.
Oh, yeah. Dressing as animals. I mean,
dressing as animals.
Behavior. You just.
You ever heard of fur parties?
Fur party. What fur?
Well, it's like you dress up in a animal costume, like, you know, at Showbiz and Chuck E. Cheese, and then people just, it's like a rave there on Ecstasy, but they have sex with each other.
Holy
and in the animal costumes. Just get in touch with your animal side, I guess. But
In the state parks?
Yeah, and these are right next to families with children, but now these people are taking these costumes and they're going swimming out with the dolphins, they're going on top of mountains, and you know, the culture is just getting sexualized. I mean, from, you know, example is the, you know, octopuses or the he'e, you know, before they were viewed as a kinolau of Kanaloa, some eras they use viewed them as a... Amakua.
Yeah.
And now you see them over people's butts and their butt cracks, you know, just for a picture, a shot.
And they just catch them and then
throw. And I, you know, we were just joking about it earlier. I still haven't been able to find one taco to this day, you know. But, then, you know, you go on social media and you see these girls naked, you know, just getting the taco, putting them on their boobs. I mean, yeah, whatever floats your boat, but... You know, these values that they're stepping on and treading on. By our kupuna that, you know, that were in balance with this land, no matter where you go.
Yeah.
Not just in Hawaii, all over the world. You got to be in balance, and, you know, but it's just that.
So it's just that disregard for the culture.
I think it's just a matter of...
quote, the host culture or the Hawaii's culture or the people here.
And just acknowledging that whole view on things are changing because the culture is getting...
They're only here for a couple of days.
Well, it's not just that. It's also locals. You know, I see guys on the west side that grew up and born there, you know, and, you know, they talk about, you know, Native Hawaiian rights or whatever. Nobody can get in my way of my Native Hawaiian rights. And the next thing, they're posting a picture of some naked chick at a cultural site, you know, and it's just like... When are you going to stop, you know, thinking about the personal fame and the good, what is it called, the warm fuzzies and the likes, and just realize that, bro, you're living on Earth and you're living in the real world, you know?
You know what I think it is? I think everyone has to, like, one-up the other guy with the photo and post it. It seems like there's this trend, and I want to call it, like, the carnivalization of recreation, where... raves are like carnival aspects, and they're going into beautiful scenic areas where before, like you said, you know, take only pictures, leave only footprints. The ethic that older generations had that new generations don't have is the respect of the resource. And what Mike is talking about is exactly right. The respect of just, you know, the cultural element of what they're doing, but wanting to be able to post it and get some kind of notoriety because it's unique. And I know that even my own daughter, kind of measures the value of what she posts by the number of likes. And I think it's this kind of psychological scorecard that people are now using to even maybe value themselves. And so they got to go to the edge of the cliff at Nepali Coast State Wilderness Park with a selfie stick and walk just like this picture. This I've actually seen a video of a guy, and it looked almost exactly like that, walking on a knife ridge with cliffs on both sides, holding a selfie stick video, and then he posted it. And the thing went viral, because that's the problem, is the footage is amazingly entertaining.
Tempting
to look.
And
yeah.
Begs you to do it one up or do that yourself.
Exactly. And someone goes, man, I want to go to that spot and I want to capture that shot. And I'm just going, man, there's no way I would walk on that ridge holding a stick up in the air. I'd be on all fours.
Okay. Believe it or not, the second hour is gone.
Cool.
Yeah. So I really appreciate you guys coming in. Kurt Cottrell, State Parks, Hawaii State Parks, Micah, Jonathan, John, Awe. I know. Anyway, but thank you guys for joining in.
Awe.
Anyway, thank you. This is the Carol Cox Show, and it was a pleasure talking to you. And Kurt, thank you for all your work. You've been around for a while. You came here as a hiker.
I did. I came here to hike to Kalalau back in 1983. So, God, what a privilege I get to manage it.
And did they have selfies? No. They didn't even have cell phones.
No, I didn't. I had an Etch-a-Sketch.
Okay, guys, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week. Aloha, this is the Carol Cox Show.
Thank you, Carol. Yeah,
thank you.
This has been the Carol Cox Show, heard every Sundays at 9 a.m. on K108. Tune in again next week, Sunday at 9 a.m. to the Carol Cox Show on 1080 a.m. KWAI Honolulu.